This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'll be speaking with Faith Boninger and Alex Molnar, who with Christopher Saldana at the National Education Policy Center at UC Boulder, have recently published a policy brief entitled Personalized Learning and the Digital Privatization of Curriculum and Teaching. Their policy brief explores the growing popularity of this technology-driven approach to teaching and learning, and the need for much higher levels of oversight for an innovation that is, if anything, depersonalizing the educational process by replacing teachers with computers. Welcome, Faith and Alex. I look forward to learning more about what you have discovered. To begin with, what is personalized learning, and how is it different from the kind of individualized instruction that could once be found in program texts?
So personalized learning is actually a pretty fuzzy concept, and advocates have intentionally shied away from providing a clear definition of it because they very much like the idea that it can be implemented differently in different settings. So that's part of the general notion. So there are a variety of definitions, but in 2014, the Gates Foundation funded a group of organizations to create a working definition of personalized learning that schools and educators could use as a guide to implementing their personalized learning programs. And that's what we've spent a lot of time unpacking because it's a fuller definition than most. And what we see there is primarily goals. So a goal to accelerate student learning by tailoring the instructional environment to address the individual needs and skills and interests of each student. A goal for students to take ownership of their own learning, and a goal for students to develop deep personal connections with others. And so in our brief, what we did was look at the assumptions about children and learning and technology that are embedded in this working definition in order to get a better sense of what exactly this approach to education is about.
You know, for most people, if you say the term personalized learning, it conjures up an image of a bespoke program for children or any person who's learning something. And I think that is, to a large extent, misleading, because although that is certainly the image that is cultivated by virtually any proponent of the current personalized learning advocacy community, in fact, the dominant push for personalized learning, a la Gates, for example, is anything but bespoke in its implementation and in its practice. In fact, it looks very like the kind of programmed instruction that was promoted by B.F. Skinner. The psychology employed is operant conditioning psychology by and large. And it is essentially very, very similar to the kind of programming that was popularized in schools in the 1950s and 1960s and into the 70s to some degree. There's very little here that's new, except the use of digital technologies. And although the language used would have us believe that these digital technologies have in some profound and meaningful way transformed teaching and learning, in fact, they haven't at all. They are very, very like, and could many of these programs could be implemented without computers by using programmed materials or even a textbook. And in fact, textbooks might actually be more supple than some of this programming. What the use of computers does, however, is allow for the collection of enormous amounts of data gathered by these digital platforms, which is justified on the basis of using these data to tailor instruction to student needs. But as you dive deeper into these programs, you see that very often, perhaps most often, this is not the case.
So In addition to the Gates Foundation, who has really been behind the advocacy for these approaches? And what do you think is making them so popular at the moment?
You know, it seems to me, and maybe it's because I'm sensitized to it, but it seems to me that personalized learning is being pushed on educators from every direction. But if you go back and follow the money, so to speak, you see that the real push is coming from the tech industry and from organizations that are associated with the tech industry, venture capital that's funding the tech industry, and philanthropic organizations like the Gates Foundation and the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. So even though you see marketing for personalized learning and promotion for personalized learning from all different kinds of places, I think that the funding for it is coming really from the tech industry.
Well, this is again, nothing particularly new. The tech industry has for decades looked for ways to transform schools from cost centers to profit centers. And essentially that means looking for more and more ways to sell products and software, whether it's hardware in the form of computers or it's software. The software platforms have certainly come to the fore most recently. This is an effort to make an awful lot of money. Venture capitalists aren't known for their philanthropy in particular. They're known for wanting the greatest possible return on any possible investment that they make. And therefore, when they invest in these technologies associated with schools, they're aiming for something very, in their minds, potentially lucrative. And that is hundreds of millions of dollars from taxpayers that will be used to buy their products and services as opposed to, for example, paying teachers, because that's where the money is in school district budgets. And that's where the money has to essentially come from. And that's why one of in our brief, we talk about the digital privatization of education, because essentially what these platforms are doing is shifting control away from local communities and teachers, and putting a lot of curriculum decisions and consequential decisions about how learning, teaching will be conducted and so on, in the hands of unknown programmers and the algorithms that they create, which are completely opaque and unavailable for inspection at this point by teachers, by school districts, or by anyone. It's hidden behind a proprietary curtain.
And something that I found really interesting, Greg, is that so often promotional materials will focus on the idea that personalized learning isn't dependent on technology. But in actuality, it is. It's a very, very friendly framework by which to bring digital products into schools.
Yeah, and I want to make a contrast that may be useful, at least for the more aged among our listeners. And that is, Greg, as you probably recall, being amongst the aged among us. in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a flowering of ideas that were to some considerable degree imported from Great Britain, but also rested on the thinking of John Dewey. In those days, it was variously labeled open education or informal education. And for many folks, the idea of personalized learning conjures up a social space with children working in, to some considerable degree, self-chosen groups to study topics of interest, and in which the teacher's responsibility is to identify the interests that students bring to the situation and select materials and choose instructional strategies that will connect the underlying content of the curriculum to the interests of the students. So you have a genuine blending of objective interests of adults who who care about and are concerned about the well-being and the good education of children, and the evolving interests and motivations and concerns of the children themselves. That's the kind of setting, this very intense social setting, very informal social setting in the at least to an outside observer, that I'm sure many people bring to mind when they hear the term personalized learning. And I would say that what we've found is that personalized learning is anything but that. It is, as it is being promoted now, it is hyper-rational. It is very, in many respects, rigid. And it is certainly outside the control of students and teachers.
You also mentioned that you feel that this particular approach, because it focuses so much on the individual, could have really serious consequences with regard to the preparation for participation in a democratic society on the part of students. Can you say more about that?
Well, yes, indeed. I'd be happy to. One of the distinctions that we attempt to illustrate in this brief is that the conception of learning that is on offer within these personalized learning programs is really a theory in which knowledge can be broken up into discrete bits and fragments, which then can then be constructed logically together, and that can be marched through in a hyper-rational fashion, one after the other after the other. And the personalization comes in when, if a student stumbles along the way, they get to do it again and again and again and again until they succeed. Or they get to go off on another contingency in which they get to do it again and again and again until they succeed. But the program itself is not really malleable in terms of the individual student and, to some degree, the individual teacher. Now, contrast that with an understanding of learning and knowledge, in which knowledge is not just a noun, it's a verb, it's created all the time. And how is it created? Well, of course, sometimes it's created by this idealized a vision of a lonely scientist sitting in her or his laboratory, toiling over experiments over and over again. But anybody who's been actually involved in science realizes that it's an enormous collaborative activity that builds on the strengths of countless people, known and unknown, at various times, and that knowledge and learning proceed in fits and starts, sometimes in unpredictable ways that are influenced by the social context, by the learning and development of the particular student or students in that context, and the interests of the moment. So these are very, very different conceptions of learning and of knowledge. And the overwhelming conception of learning and of knowledge that is embedded in these digital platforms is one which is very rigid, very linear, very hyper-rational.
You argue that there's currently little oversight or accountability with regard to personalized learning and make a number of recommendations. I'd like to walk through these and have you say more about why they are necessary and what you hope they will accomplish. You call for the external review and approval of program curriculum materials by independent third-party education experts. Why is this kind of review needed?
We recommend that states establish an independent, disinterested government entity that will review digital products to be used for personalized learning. That's the overarching recommendation. So the entity would establish processes of review and approval of the programs and all aspects of what they bring into schools by third-party education experts. So it goes back to what Alex said earlier about the programming being completely opaque. We don't know who's creating them. We don't know what their biases are. We don't know what's being baked into the programs. The product in this kind of situation is what becomes responsible for the pedagogical activities and educational decision-making. So that means who? That means the business people. That means the programmers that they hire. Through the product, these are the people who are teaching students. They're the people who are assessing student progress, determining the path of study, and so on. All of those important educational decisions need to be brought into the light, how they're being made. And so that's why we think that there needs to be an independent entity to establish review of these programs before they're brought into schools.
Well, right now, Greg, we have no idea of the expertise of the people who are writing the curriculum that is being used in these programs. By and large, who are they? So if you have a recommendation to visit this website, that website, or the other website, who's reviewed that website? And what awaits students when they arrive at that website? Is it a host of third-party aggregators of those students' data who will do who knows what with it? What is awaiting for them? If you, as you know, one of the most hotly contested issues in American education is the content of what children are taught. There are enormously emotional, strongly fought battles over the content of the school curriculum. To a large degree, this is putting the curriculum behind a veil that nobody can really see. It is putting assessment behind a veil that nobody really understands. So if you have, for example, a program that says, well, the student didn't do this, have them do this instead, and so on, you have no idea what the programmer's logic or thinking was in making those decisions. You're left with a choice of either, well, you're not left with a choice at all. I was going to say rejecting or accepting it, but that really isn't a choice because the program's made the decision. Now, obviously, amongst programs, there's some variation. But what a common element of them all is that none of them have been reviewed by independent third-party experts who have certified the content of the curriculum that they offer, the validity of the instructional approaches that they're using, the reliability and validity of the assessment that is built into these programs. And there is currently really very little in the way of safeguards with regard to how all of the information that's gathered is used, how it's aggregated, how it is protected, how it might be sold on and monetized. There's virtually no effective public oversight of this.
So with regard to the assessment tools, what kinds of things do you think could be done to actually kind of assure that students are in fact meeting the requirements for particular grade levels? And I know one of the things that struck me in reading the article was the notion that teachers might have no real clear understanding about what it was that students have actually mastered. Do you have any thoughts about, like, if these programs were to remain in existence, what kinds of things could be done to in fact make them credible?
Faith, you want to take that one?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that if these programs go under serious review, what will be found is that there really needs to be a stop on using them until that question could be answered. Because unless it's completely transparent, then I don't think that they're actually usable in terms of the assessment. What do you think, Alex?
Well, I don't think they are either. I mean, the fact of the matter is, what you're being asked is, you're being asked to turn over the education of children to self-interested, profit-motivated entities that have no legal responsibility to do very much at all to deliver what they promise. And they have no legal requirement to prove that they even can deliver what they promise. And that's why it seems to us that if, for example, the Gates Foundation, which has been heavily involved in funding this push toward so-called personalized learning, it's really better stated as personalized instruction, and it's even better stated as technologized instruction. If they have a little extra cash laying around, it might be well spent promoting policies to create independent bodies that could bring expertise and transparency to the examination of any software platform that is being proposed for use in schools, and to disallow the use of any software platform that has not gone through such a public review.
So do you have a sense of why state departments of education and local districts have been so ready to kind of accept these new approaches when they haven't been vetted and are so problematic?
Well, they sound really great. I mean, if you read the promotional materials, if you go to a conference somebody from a district that's implemented it is invited to talk about how great it is, if you do a tour of various programs that are presented to you in a way that's very positive, it sounds awesome. It sounds child-centered in the way that Alex was describing earlier. And so I think that district leaders are looking to find a solution to their problems, and it's offered as a solution. Whether it's the correct solution or not is absolutely another story, but it's offered as one. And there's this notion of being up to date that's desirable, of working well with the business community. So I think that there's a lot of motivated reasoning going on.
I think there's that. And I also think, Greg, that there's an awful lot of money behind pushing this. And state departments of education and school districts do not have the expertise amongst their staff to do what it is we're proposing. And that's why I said, you know, if the Gates Foundation actually wanted to have this programming be considered seriously in terms of its vetting for its content and its payoff and its validity, then surely they would be helping to fund the public expertise that is necessary to conduct the kinds of reviews of these materials that are essential if we're going to have any faith in them at all, and if they're not going to do more harm than any possible good.
There's one topic that we've only kind of alluded to briefly, and that has to do with student privacy and the need to really find ways to make sure that the kind of material that is surfaced as a result of these programs is not made available for commercial purposes. You lay out a number of recommendations about things that could be done to try to forestall that. Could you say more about just student privacy and the need to find very particular ways to protect it?
First of all, I'd say that it's student and teacher privacy, because a lot of data is collected on teachers as well. So we've got this issue of so much data being collected, and the rationale for the data being collected is to be able to provide teachers with all of the information necessary and provide the program with all of the information necessary to help students follow their learning pathways. But if you look carefully at the privacy policies for the personalized learning products, you see that there's not so much explanation of what's collected and what the purposes are for its collection and with whom the data is shared. And so, again, going back to this disinterested entity, independent entity that we think should be set up to examine the various products, it would be very important for there to be a transparent, easy-to-read privacy policy that would specify which data are being collected, for what purpose, with whom they'll be shared, how they'll be protected, so that it's not the kind of thing where you're told, well, you know, we're using this education management software, and it connects to a whole bunch of different products, and the education management software is going to collect a whole bunch of data to help improve your experience, and the other third-party software to which it connects will also collect a whole bunch of data, and the education management software provider isn't taking any responsibility for where it's sending you as a child, and you should really go and look and examine the privacy policies of all of these various programs to make sure that you are willing to accept them. And then if you're not willing to accept them, I don't know what happens. I mean, there's really no recourse. That's not tenable. And all of these data, from the minute they're collected, they're susceptible to theft, misuse.
There's no legal framework in most instances, Greg, that would allow this to be prohibited. So imagine a world in which if a vendor wanted to do business in, let's say, Wisconsin or Arizona or Oregon or anywhere, the state said, you're not getting anywhere near a school. Here is the privacy policy that we have embodied we have put into law. You will sign a legal contract that says you will abide by this policy, and there are civil and penalties if you fail to do this. In other words, you have to affirmatively protect the privacy of those people from whom you gather data, period. You have no choice. And this will be your privacy policy, not one written by your lawyers. It will be one written by the state. Here it is. If you wish to do business in this state, you sign this policy. Right now, there is absolutely nothing like that at all. And so, as Faith said, you have this collection of opaque, obscure, and in some instances, almost ludicrous privacy policies. And no enforcement mechanism, no follow through, and no real expertise even to understand what is being said. This stuff is simply placed in the schools.
Thanks, Faith and Alex, for your heads up about another example of ways corporations are making money off public schools by sponsoring and disseminating questionable and potentially damaging educational practices. Hopefully, your call for increased regulation of these practices will result in action from state and district-level policymakers. This is Greg Smith for the National Education Policy Center. Today's podcast concludes our series for the 2018-2019 academic year. I hope that you found these conversations to be as illuminating as I have. Thanks for your interest and support.